Okay, we're ready to go. And this presentation is by Keith Henson and Leo Busted, and it's entitled The Plight of the Handicapped and What We Should Do About It, which is a pretty big assignment for 50 minutes. And Keith is going to begin, and he'll ask him to introduce himself and then to carry on.
My name's Keith Henson, and I took my Master of Divinity degree a few years back and got interested in working with the chronically acute mentally ill in institutions, and particularly in state hospitals. I then did a year and a half residency as an institutional chaplain, a mental health chaplain, and became a clinical member of the Association of Clinical Pastoral Educators. And subsequently, I took a Master of Social Work degree, again concentrating on work with the mentally ill. And a few months back, Leo sent me an article by a person who had been in an institution entitled Close the Institutions, and he asked me to comment on this and on their plight. By necessity, I'm going to have to limit this to my area of expertise, which is people that have been institutionalized for chronic mental illness, and particularly in state hospitals. And as to the generalizability of what I'm going to say to other institutions, that'll be for you to try to figure out and to work with. But one of the things I think at Holden we should ask is why should Christians be concerned about mental illness and the way we run our institutions? And why do we have such a chaplaincy ministry in state hospitals? And I think the answer is pretty clear in that Jesus was who became voluntarily vulnerable, associated with the vulnerable all throughout his ministry. And so often the vulnerable, then as now, are handicapped persons. There's a link between the ministry of Jesus and handicapped people. And that included the severely mentally ill. And I'm sure all of you are aware of the story of the demoniac at Garanzanez, where the spirits were put into those pigs that Leo enjoys so much and run off the cliff. But the healing ministry of Jesus in the miracle stories in the New Testament always allowed for the kingdom or the dominion of God to break through. And I think that that's no less true today. There's a tremendous need and tremendous opportunities for direct and indirect ministry with people with severe mental or emotional disturbances. And at the very least, I think the church should continue to be concerned about such people. In what I'm going to say, I'm going to, by necessity, have to greatly abbreviate and condense and try to fit the history of the world here into 50 minutes. But it seems like around 1600s, we get the idea of really starting to institutionalize the way social deviance is handled, at least in the West. We get the rise of the poorhouses, prisons, and asylums for the insane, in a really big fashion. And at the time, those things like poorness, mental illness, and criminal behavior were all considered moral failures. And it was felt through the workhouses in England, for example, that through training people to be industrious, self-discipline, privation, and work, that somehow people could be re-educated and their moral failings could be remedied, and that they would join the mainstream of society. And the whole philosophy behind that, I think, shows a lack of compassion as we look back on it. I'm not saying that at the time that was necessarily happening, but when we look back on it, we can see, I think, that there was compassion was sorely missing, at least if not in the formation of those institutions, then in what happened subsequently. For example, the mentally ill being chained to walls, or in France, how that they were used as a diversion and entertainment for the nobility who would come to see them instead of, they didn't have movies or whatever, they had the entertainment of looking at the mentally ill people. And I think that there was have been a general trend then to consider the mentally ill, the severely mentally ill, as less than human or as subhuman, or at best have lost their capacity in so many functioning areas of what we consider human behavior, that they were looked upon as less than human beings and treated as such. Yesterday we heard Leo, if you were here for Leo's session, we heard about the, sort of the humanizing of the institutions and the induction of compassion into the whole process with Pinel in France and Tuca in the 1700s. So that we still get the idea of the asylum or institution to put people, to maintain people, and to keep them out of the community, but at least now we have the introduction of humane treatment. Or not treatment, medical treatment, or treatment for their mental illness exactly, but at least we have humane treatment of them and their basic needs. Then a little bit later, after that, we start getting into trying to treat mental illness. So we got maintenance plus treatment, which was a step forward. However, by our standards, the type of treatment that was offered seems barbaric. Probably some of you are aware of them, but the first state hospital I worked at was built in 1869, and they still had the leftover therapeutic modalities hanging around the place. For example, hydrotherapy, where they would wrap people up in ice-cold towels, then take those off and put them in real hot towels, and then cold and hot, and they would do that for hours on end. Or they had a big thing that they would strap them to that would spin them around, you know, spin them like this and then spin them like this, and this was hoped that somehow that would help them. And it probably did control their behavior, manage their behavior somewhat. Because if you're doing something and, you know, they strap you to a big wheel and spin you around, there's a good chance you might not do that again. It doesn't necessarily help your mental illness, but it certainly help your behavior somewhat. But the idea of the asylum stayed even when we had treatment, and the primary treatment modality at that time was work. That's what that was seen, again, harkening back to the poorhouse idea, that it is work that will set people free from their mental illness. And consequently then, around the turn of the century, we had the state hospitals, the state institutions, and you all have them in your state, that probably, if you look closely, had connected to them giant farms across the street, maybe, or connected to the property. There was a giant farm system that went along. Some of the state hospitals then had factories as well, producing surplus revenue for the state and produced by free court-committed labor. And who was there then around the turn of the century? Who were these people in the state institutions? Well, they were the ones who were obviously mentally ill, the same people that are there today. But in addition, you had a lot less tolerance for social deviance back then. And so you would get eccentrics, people who were eccentric, who didn't have a lot of family support, or people that were committing acts that were considered socially deviant. Or you had different criteria depending on which part of society you were from. For example, blacks and women were judged by a different standard for mental illness, a different criteria. So what we have in addition is the state institutions acting as a form of social control, working to keep people in particular roles in society. And there's some excellent literature on this, but if you're interested in the feminist perspective on this, I would recommend Chesler's book on women and madness, which is a sort of a seminal work in this, and subsequently Mary Daly's Gyne Ecology, which has a really illuminating chapter on some of the things that were done in the state hospital, in particular with women. So what we have at the turn of the century then is we have mentally ill people concentrated in a particular area. We have them working for the state, long hours, uncompensated and producing revenue for the state, and the institution's being used as a form of social control. There, at the time, the idea was that the people would never leave the state hospital, that they would always stay there, and that we still have the asylum concept, although the treatment area is moving us, the treatment is moving us in the way of becoming a hospital as well. Well, two main things happened then to change the way we had things at the beginning of the century, to turn the asylum into a hospital. And there are many things, but the two major ones are the advance of psychotropic medications, or, you know, being able to prescribe medications that, if it would not cure mental illness, would at least help people to manage their delusions, to calm people down, and so that was one of the things that really helped. It was reflected in the architecture. Before that time, you know, you'd go in the old state hospitals and they'd have huge doors on them, solid wood. And then after the psychotropic medications, they were able to put normal doors with locks on them. Because before, patients would be able, like in manic rages, to literally tear doors off their hinges. You don't have those sort of problems now because people can be given medications to manage them, and it's very rare that you have someone with those sorts of superhuman strength that they would have in a manic rage back then. The other thing that happened is in 1972 there was a very important legislation passed that called for less restrictive alternatives to be offered to people in state institutions, and that's, you know, the deinstitutionalization. So in 1972 we can say that that's sort of the pronouncement of death of the asylum concept. And then we have only psychiatric hospitals forward from there. These statistics indicate just some of the trend that happened. In 1933, there were 395,000 people in mental hospitals, which it indicated 315 people per 100,000 in the population. 3 years after deinstitutionalization, we have 238,000 people, and that's 113 per 100,000. So despite the great rise in population in this country, we have a lot less people now in mental institutions than we did back in 1933. So what's the situation now, moving forward quickly? Nowadays in state hospitals, generally, most people are 50% of the people that are admitted are released within 72 hours. They come in, they might show signs of mental illness, and subsequently, after having them locked up for 3 days, it might turn out, for example, they have cocaine psychosis. 3 days without cocaine, their psychotic symptoms disappear, they're out. Someone gets drunk, comes in, says, is despondent, says they're going to kill themselves, they sober up, within 72 hours they say, no, I'm thinking clearly now, I'm not going to do that, and they're out. We have, you know, people who come in very quickly. Then we have the other group, which comes in, the other 50%, and those are probably people that are going to have, generally, at least a 6-month admission, at least. Usually a little bit longer, but 6 months. Then they'll go out, and they'll be out for 6 months to 2 years, although some people will be out a lot shorter period of time and some a lot more. And that's, of course, the revolving door you've probably heard so much about. People come in for a short period of time, go out, and then they have to come in, back in. We call it, they're in for their 50,000-mile tune-up. And rather than seeing that as a failure, we see that as a success sometimes, because people who had formerly have not been able to spend any time in the community are now able to for shorter periods of time, or for some period of time. But the other group is who I really want to talk about. Those are the people who are in the state hospital, who will be in the state hospital for a long period of time, and they are people who will be in the hospital anywhere from 5 to 15 to 25, as many as 25 years. And the situation we have now, and this is part of what I want to talk about, the plight of these persons, is that we have them living now in the state hospitals as if they were in a hospital. There is no provision currently in any state for people to live at the state hospital with the idea of asylum or as a permanent resident. All patients are considered the same when they come in, and it doesn't matter if they're going to be there for 6 months and leave or they're going to be there for 15 years. And I see that as a real issue. Someone was mentioning about the cycle of deinstitutionalization. So what we've gone from is not letting anybody out to acting like we're going to let everyone out. And I think that that represents a real need that needs to be looked at and addressed. Who are these long-term people that are staying in the hospital? And when I say they stay in the hospital, that means that they're treated just like everyone else, in that they might be in a room with three or four people in a room not much bigger than the size of this fireplace. Literally, you know, they'll have one bed on one side and a mattress on the floor that you have to step over. They'll be transferred at the whims of the hospital. They have no sense of permanence on a ward, as if they live there, because they're merely a patient on this ward, and they could be transferred at any time to a completely different place. Even though they may have been there on this place for 5 years, they may come in one day and the next day they're at another ward. So who are these people that are staying a long time? Well, basically and honestly, they're the therapeutic failures of every psychiatric or therapy, every psychological therapy or of treatment modalities. They're the failures of every treatment that's known to modern psychiatric science. They've had everything tried for them, and they're just the ones that do not respond. They've filtered through the community systems, and finally, there's just nothing that seems to help. They're there. Generally, their families are very burned out. We're talking about some people who have 30 admissions in 2 years' time. Some of them. For example, on the ward, one ward I worked on, I have 30 people. It would be rare to have more than two visitors a night for all those 30 people. Their families are very burned out, you know, after 10 or 15 years of going through this process. They just don't have any resources anymore to invest. And these people are heavily institutionalized. Now, there are two ways to get into state hospitals nowadays. That's to be a danger to yourself or to be a danger to others. And in some states, not all states, but in some states they have danger to self. Also, you can be gravely disabled. Not all states have that. You have to be a clear danger to yourself before you can be admitted, like in Ohio where I'm from. Just being out on the streets and not being able to take care of yourself is not enough. You have to wait till it's a life-threatening situation. Then they can be brought in. So if the danger to self aspect represents the compassionate part of institutions and why institutions are formed, we can hold that up and we can talk about these eight institutions being provided for the welfare of the individual. The other side of the coin is the danger to others. And clearly that represents not necessarily the interests of the individual, but the interests of the state. Or the public interest, which are difficult things to define. And in doing so, the interests of the person are necessarily diminished because we're putting the interests of the state on par with the interests of the person. Now, in the ideal world, these things would not clash, but that's unfortunately not the case at this point. Then we get institutionalization as a byproduct of the institution itself. Because in the final analysis, even though we have the person's interest at heart and the interests of the state, the interests of the institution will weigh out, or will win out. They will carry the most weight. The convenience of the institution is primary. And by necessity, institutionalization is dehumanizing. And I'll give you an example of what I mean. Say for food, what you eat. Now, while you're at Holden Village, you don't really have much. When you go to your meals, you don't have much choice about what you eat while you're here. But you do have a choice of leaving if you want and going down and you get out of here and getting what you want. In the state hospital, you don't have a choice about what you eat. It's presented to you, and that's done for the convenience of the institution. They can't afford, they don't have resources, etc., to provide four entrees so that people would have some sort of choice. So there's one entree. And what a person eats, then they can't leave, they can't go down to the McDonald's, they can't supplement their diets. They're forced to eat what's there. And so there's a loss of autonomy as far as what you'll eat. There's a loss about privacy rights, not only in what people know about you, but what you're able to do in privacy. For example, if you're on a mental hospital ward, there isn't a place you can go to be by yourself, generally. There's not a provision for that. And basically, you're surrounded by crazy people, which, if you're starting to get well, just increases your want to become more isolated, because the weller you get, the more you see what's going on around you, and then that you start to go back inside. That's a common dynamic, because it's a very stressful, it's a very noisy atmosphere. There's a lack of privacy. There's a loss of sexual rights. Sexual behavior is not tolerated in the state hospitals. And you say, well, if you're only going to be there for 6 months, well, I can see where that would, you know, people can control that for 6 months maybe. But what do you do if you're there for 6 years or 12 years and you're not allowed to be a sexual person, that's against the rules in the institution? Intimacy. Where I work, people are not allowed to walk down the halls holding hands. You know, that's a sort of sexual behavior. It's a type of intimacy that's not allowed in the state institutions. And you can see people putting up with that or standing it for 6 months, but when you start getting into long term, it really does not fulfill basic human needs. So I've taken the long way around here, I know, but I'd just like to say that one of the things then we do in the ministry in the state institutions is to try to call forth the fact that this is a person, that this is a human being, that these people in there have basic needs just like you and I. One of the Ernest Bruder, who was a chaplain at St. Elizabeth's in Washington, D.C., used to say of the mentally ill, the mentally ill are just like you and I, only more so. That these are human beings with real needs, people who want to be productive in meaningful ways, and that doesn't mean picking up styrofoam cups on the state hospital grounds for 25 cents an hour when you have a college degree. I mean, you know, these people want to be productive, and they have needs that want to be met. They want to be taken seriously because their delusions and they are very real to them. It's critical, and they want to be taken seriously and to show that you have dignity for them. They are lonely and isolated. I've talked about a lot of them have their families that are burned out on them. They don't have a lot of social support. So in ministry to these people, it can take the form of throwing a baseball. I had a guy that used to enjoy a visit once a week where we'd go out and toss the baseball. That's all. That was important to him. A coffee klatch. Running a coffee klatch for a group of people who never get off a ward to go someplace and have coffee and treats and to interact socially. That's really a meaningful thing. It says that this person is considered important as a person. There's types of advocacy you can do. You know, and when it comes to allocation of resources, the mentally ill are at the bottom of the barrel. There's severe overcrowding. There's a lack of resources, lack of staff. Many state hospitals have lost accreditation and are no longer even able to be accredited by the Joint Commission for Accreditation of Hospitals, no longer allowed to have board-certified psychiatrists, no longer able to have students. And this is directly related to the loss of funding. Churches have been known to provide transitional living situations, which is always needed. And I think it's important to remember that institutions, the state institutions, are set up for patients, for people in them to be ignored. They're off, they're behind walls, they're locked in, and it is easy to ignore them. And the only time you hear about them, generally, is when there's scandal in the institutions or when someone from the institution has escaped and commits a crime, and then you find it blazoned on the headlines of newspapers. So I think there's a great deal of ministry that can be done to showing those people there that they too are children of God and that they're important and that they can't be ignored. And Leo's going to talk a bit about how to institute some programs for helping to ease that loneliness, to take into consideration that people have needs for intimacy, the need to be needed and to be loved and to express love. And he's got some things to say about that involving pet partnerships. But I would encourage anybody in the church to seek out and find out what's happening in your state mental institutions. Call the chaplain there. They all have one. Ask him what the needs are. Ask if you can be of help. There's all sorts of financial needs. But I really think, just to leave you with this, is when the demoniac is cured in the New Testament and comes up to Jesus and begs to go with him, I think that this what Jesus has to say to us is really critical. It says in Luke 8:38, "The man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might be with him, but he sent him away saying, 'Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you.' And he went away proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for him." I think it would be one of the greatest blessings in the world that we would have someone that we were involved in ministry with in the state hospital to be able to return home and to say to others, "Look what God did for me through his servant, you or me," and to be able to be a witness to the world to that. So basically, I think that's all I have to say, and there's a lot I left unsaid. But before we move on to Leo, is there any comments or questions anyone wants to respond to?
Do they have such things as halfway houses for the mentally ill, so when they do reach a point where they can function, they can move on to that and not go into themselves, as you say, being surrounded by those who are more ill than?
Yes, ma'am, and that's there's two groups I'm talking about. One group does that. You know, they come out and they get well enough and they go into congregate care facilities or halfway houses or even more intensive type programs. And there's a large portion of that are doing that. But what I'm talking about is yet another group who will never leave the state hospital. And there is a large group of people like that. Yeah, there are those places, and those are important to get people back into the community. They're not liked by the patients, by the way, though. You won't, in my experience, as a social worker, trying to get people to go to these places, they're generally not hot to do it. Because, again, it's a very high-density situation. It's like being in college all your life, living in a very small room. There's a lack of privacy. There's a lack of autonomy, and the people who leave, they want to be out on their own. They want to go and be just like you and I and not do that.
Are these the people, then, that we hear so much about that end up being street people or homeless people who really are mentally ill and really can't function totally on their own? So there are places for them. They choose not to go there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the people I'm talking about who are there are people who are generally considered a danger to others. That's the main thing keeping them in there. For example, if you have someone with a diagnosis of schizophrenia with pedophilia, you know, has been involved in molesting children or something, the chances of ever getting that person into a halfway house are about zero. That person's going to be in the state hospital, or else they're going to be bumped out by the courts. The state hospital won't release them because of the liability.
Yes. I had two brothers, both declared schizophrenia. Okay, I got them out of the hospital in Minnesota and transferred them to Washington. I got them both out on home care. I had one brother live with me for 13 years. I took them everywhere, and they functioned pretty well. They needed somebody, though, because they didn't have, self-esteem any longer. Everything was gone. Somebody had always opened the door and let them through and locked it up again. And my brother died about 2 years ago, now the one, and he said he really had enjoyed being with me. 13 years, he said I was outside, and he just enjoyed it. But what happens if they stayed back east, no family, parents gone, they would have stayed in that institution forever.
Yeah. And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Back in Minnesota, they were also been very cold in the winter and hot in the summer.
And Minnesota is a very progressive state. Yes, sir.
Something, this is a little different, but yet it's pertaining to what you're talking about. Back in my hometown, we have a big hospital for the retarded folks long term. And back in the 40s and 50s, we had the farm there. And they took it away later. And it's, I can understand what you're saying about the whole situation, but when those folks were able to work on the farm, they loved it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they felt productive. They felt like each of them had their own cow to take care of. They worked in the fields. And that farm got state awards for the best production. And it's, I can see what you're saying, but yet it's too bad they did take them away, because I think they have a valuable service.
Yeah, and the need to be productive is well taken.
Let's make a point here for what the discussion is in this case was back in the 40s, farms for people who were mentally disturbed and others were very useful and helpful, and they really enjoyed it. And then they closed them, as you and I have talked about. Now, continue from there.
Well, with deinstitutionalization, though, what happened is that the patients who were very high-functioning, who were able to help with the farms, went out into the community. And then the people that were left were those that weren't able to go out into the community, which are generally very low-functioning and were not able to take care of the farms. And I was running a community garden recently with a ward, and it took us over a week just to plant, like, you know, this many vegetables. You have to get down, and it's very intensive sort of instruction about how to do this. And that we don't see the same sort of people in the hospitals now that we saw back even in the 1960s. And we had people were a lot higher functioning in the 1960s in the state hospitals than they are now.
And one other question, has there been a follow-up to the higher functioning folks that left and went into the community, if they felt more productive on the farms or in the community?
Well, not that I know of. Yeah, but you're raising an issue that still, you know, I hear it all the time at the state hospital. The days of the farm were the halcyon days of the state institutions. And I think that needs some serious critical examination. Again, because the times were much different. The hospital I worked at in Ohio had 3,000 people going when they were running the farms. And when I left, they had 600 people. The hospital I'm working at now, Western State, once had over 2,000 people. Now they have 1,100, but have closed other institutions and consolidated. So it's like comparing apples and oranges. The times are much different. the population is much different. But I'm into horticultural therapy. The other thing I think that needs to be pointed out again is there was much exploitation that was going on with the state farm systems. For example, in one state hospital in Massachusetts in 1900 was producing $6 million surplus in the shoe factory being used to support other state programs, infrastructure, roads, using people who are committed, using their free labor to support other types of programs. And if that were done in another country, we would call that a concentration camp and slave labor.
Also, in some institutions, such as prisons, they might have some people who are supervising and doing such a great job, they'd hesitate to release them, although they right. could make it out there, but they wanted to keep them doing a good job.
The other thing is the unionization of the state hospitals. Yeah, patients are no longer allowed to do things that they were once doing because it is a job that is being done currently by a union employee. For example, if a patient, we have patients who were electronics wanted to do some fixing of the unit stereo system, and they were not allowed to do that because it was, there are certain rules about what can be done. Well, that isn't a good example, but there are certain things about you can't have them help the plumbers, for example. Like if you have someone that was a plumber, you can't have them go around on the state hospital grounds being a plumber's assistant.
Gardening.
Well, they have gardening now, but they don't do it to support the hospital population. So there's a unionization. Just that dynamic alone eliminates a lot of the employment that might be done or training that might be done on the state hospital grounds. Well, I should let Leo now talk about some ways that he's using pets.
I have to reflect a couple of comments I can't persist doing. You mentioned this old-time therapy, which seems terrible, to expose them to real cold, or real hot, and then real cold. And we continue to do that, in fact, in the upriver sauna. We're doing it all the time here. We speak of institutions. We should define some things here. I'm from a university, and we define the difference between an institution and a university. You have to improve to get out of an institution. And when I was, I saw what you saw, because when I was in high school, I'd be judging cattle, for example, in FFA at the mental hospital and at the prisons. And they had some very fine herds. And I was impressed with the people that were working on them. They seemed to really be enjoying it, and they had cats around. They had a lot of animals, and, of course, also on the farm. So I thought that was a very good thing. And, of course, for various reasons, they did close them. And you see, the people that were there had an agrarian background, which is not so true now. And we have many models now for that we can utilize to say, here's some things we ought to try. And as far as addressing this issue, I congratulate Keith for setting the stage for this and defining the problem and the plight of these people. And he himself, I know you bring out coffee cake and stuff, and I thought you took them also to the Big Mac or something. I shouldn't say that because that's not allowed.
No, that's allowed.
Oh, okay. But there are a lot of things, and I hope you've caught that. There's a lot of possibilities here. And you mentioned schizophrenics, and I know several psychiatrists who would like to get going to put them in a farm situation with animals on a supervision. May be prove very useful. But what the plight here, or the plea for all of this situation, is what you manifested by taking your brothers in. We need compassion for these people. I think it's in Matthew, in one translation, be ye compassionate as your Father is compassionate. So the plea is then for compassion, for knowledge about this. And if I took one of my classes at the university and said, how many of you know a handicapped person as a person? You'd probably get very few hands. And one of, and some of you, how many of you were there last night for my presentation? Quite a few of you. Well, I discussed a program we initiated many years ago at a university we call the People Pet Partnership, which involves education of children from preschool to sixth grade, bringing animals by placement or visitation, means in with handicapped people to into nursing homes, convalescent homes, into hospitals, riding for the handicapped, and into prisons. And for example, our Riding for the Handicapped program, or encouraging these students to go in and see old people. When I taught at Perth University, at Murdoch University, and none of my students had ever been to a nursing or convalescent home when I taught a course in Reverence for Life. Well, we want them to go there and learn to know an old person and a handicapped person as a person. And I've seen it in our own program in Riding for the Handicapped. I saw it in at that time, the largest Riding for the Handicapped was in the Diamond Center for the Handicapped south of London, where they had, I think, over 700 signed up per week. And most of this is done, in our case, with volunteer helpers. And they used a lot of teenagers. Some of ours are in their late teens or early 20s, although some from the community also do it. But I've seen, I'll never forget this letter this student wrote. He was kind of searching for something to do for a week or two after school was out, and we had our Riding for the Handicapped summer program for a week for the mentally and then a week for the physically disabled. And we assigned, and the student told us, why don't you join us and be a volunteer, and we'll assign you this severe cerebral palsy person whose main method of communication was this was no and this was yes and the gradations in between. And it was a great week for both of them. At first he was he didn't know that, well, this was a very good thing to do. But after a week of it, he wrote a letter. It really changed his life because he first learned to know a person as a handicapped person as a person. And also the handicapped person got a certificate, the only certificate he'd ever gotten in his life for completion of something. And that's what we're trying to do. And that's why I want the students to go in and teach as a pet professor to the children. I'll never forget what the people told me at Diamond Center for the Handicapped, south of London. They said they get all kinds of calls from the parents of these teenagers that come over and work with these people. They can't understand. They're almost humane, after a period of time. It just does change them. And we've seen this in prisons. And I'm talking about a maximum security prison for women that we've been working in now for 8 years. The change that has happened to these prisoners dealing with these animals, which they now have night and day with them. That's why the animals are so well trained, because they're with them continually. And we had quite a struggle to get them to allow them to have their animals with them in their cell. But they have now a suitable object of nurture. And I said last night to you that who are benefited most by animal introduction. And they are those who lack objects of nurture, in many cases themselves not had nurture and compassion. And many of the prisoners I've seen, and I've been in a few prisons, there's a lot of people there that are there because they didn't have nurture or suitable nurture. And they are so designed and programmed that they are not to have nurture or can have objects of nurture. You can't touch a prisoner and they are not to touch. Just like your people in your situation are not allowed to touch. And everybody needs tactile stimulation. That's why animals with old people are so remarkable, you see. And the people I'm talking about, the handicapped children, when you have a disabled child in a wheelchair, that wheelchair is an obstacle to socialization. They've actually, and my friends in California did a study on this. They took, they got a whole bunch of children disabled in wheelchairs, They studied them as to how many people talked to them. And then they took them to a shopping center and recorded the number of contacts people made in them. One group that didn't have an animal with them, and a group that had an animal with them. And they were. A wheelchair is an obstacle to socialization. Very few people come and see you. And I tried this out myself, and not by intention. I had traumatic phlebitis, and I had to use a wheelchair some, and I was traveling a lot. And they'd take me out of the airplane and put me on a wheelchair when it was 110 degrees in the shade on the tarmac and no shade, and people would give you a wide berth in a wheelchair, and you'd finally get into a terminal, and the spigot for the water fountain was higher than you could, and the john was unavailable. And that's still happening. Well, when they had these animals with them, that is, then you're very popular. In fact, you're more popular probably than if you had a baby buggy with a baby in it. In fact, a friend of mine from Cambridge, a behaviorist, he and his friend went into a park in London, sat on a bench and watched the interaction of people with people coming into the park, those with the baby buggies and those alone, and then those with animals, with dogs. And the people with dogs won hands down as far as contact. At the last Delta Society meeting in Orlando, Florida, my friend Diane Rush from the Midwest, she had animals, pets, dogs, and cats, but she decided to bring her favorite rabbit, Hershey, to Orlando. I haven't seen too many people bring rabbits to meetings, but we're a strange lot. And there were a lot of people there in a beautiful hotel, large, expansive lobby. On the second or third day of the meeting, she sat down in a chair in the lobby in a very prominent place for 1.5 hours. Nobody came and talked to her. So she ran up and got Hershey, the rabbit, and sat down there, and she had 21 visitors in a half an hour. So to make the point, you see, but there's so many people that with an animal, some responsibility for it. They have an object of nurture. They have something that's depending on them, so they are needed. Everybody needs to feel needed to have some self-image, positive self-image. And this, what a properly placed animal or a visitation animal even, will help do that for them. I just now thought of one lady that was in a nursing home. And she came into this nursing home and wasn't communicating with anybody. And what I'm telling you now, it's a true case, and it's repeated over and over and over again, no matter whether it's in Australia or in Norway, although a lot of places don't allow animals, but in Germany or Holland or England or wherever. And this lady had been there quite a while. This veterinarian had some very good dogs, and his associates would take them in to visit these people. And he'd bring his dog, one of his dogs, try out another dog with this lady who was always there in her wheelchair. And no takes. She was just ignored him essentially. And he got a cat. And the cats have a great variation in their character. Some are almost like a dog, and others are independent as hogs on ice. And in this case, it was kind of a hugger. Some cats are huggers, and they're very good for therapy. And the ones I know about most have been rescued, have had a very difficult time of it, and by human compassion and care have recovered and done very well. In fact, several of them are now in a therapy situation that I know of. In this case, this was that kind of a cat. It had a tough time. He nursed it back, and it really did well. And so he decided to, on this day, not only take some dogs down there, but this cat. He had gotten the dogs and let them loose to go around. and had them placed with the people and kind of make the rounds. And then he opened up the cat cage. And this cat went down past people that were trying to get it, ran over and jumped in the lap of this lady that I told you about on her wheelchair. And he put his hands to his head and says, "Oh, no." And he went running over there to interrupt this because he thought it would be really turn her off. By the time he got there, she was talking to the cat, telling it how she was missing her cat. That would meant so much to her, the only thing she had. And there's a lot of people like that. That's the only thing they have. It's their child. And she was communicating, talking about this, and it was the opening for this. And I can give you so many examples of this. I sent you yesterday, one of our worst diseases is loneliness. And I believe that. And when I gave the Wesley Spink lectures at the University of Minnesota, Wesley Spink, the late Wesley Spink, famous physician, and the dean of the medical school there, you know, we talked about this. And they both agreed that in their experience, and these are people in internal medicine chiefly, that this is a bad disease. We are coming around to that now, realizing lonesomeness probably messes up also something to do with your cholesterol. It's a stressful thing. It's an unhealthy situation. And to many people, probably more than half the people, a proper introduction to the right animal can go a long ways to relieving this loneliness. And we have the model that I mentioned in Giel, Belgium, starting in 800 or 900, before the institutionalized thing. They realized that how they were treating people, handicapped people, was wrong. So they take them in to live with them. And that's what happened with the Christians in Westphalia at Bethel in 1867. Probably using the model of the Tuck brothers in 1792. Which they did the same thing and introduced them to animals. And that's what they did at Bethel. And they don't talk about it, but they say this is a normal kind of a thing. They have big farm complexes and it just works. So that's our plea that we give this a trial, that we gain knowledge of this, to follow what Keith has said about this, to become involved in this, better handling methods and compassion and proper selection and introduction of animals. There's a lot of data available on this and more coming out all the time from the Delta Society, and I can give you the address of that where you can write for. We have all kinds of packets of information. So that's where I'm coming from, in brief. So you can leave if you want to. It's they're going to eat in about 8 minutes.
You can talk some more if you want. I just have one comment, and it's very directly related. And it's a very simple thing to think about, but I work with young children that have handicaps, and it's the simple phrasing of saying, instead of saying that this child has Down syndrome or that this is a Down syndrome child, and if you just switch it around and you say it's a child with Down syndrome, you're acknowledging the personhood first and the disability second. And if you can remember that when you're dealing with situations with other people, or if you can get that in your own thinking, that it's a person who is orthopedically handicapped, the person who is mentally ill, it is a person who has, you know, whatever, but it's the fact that it's personhood first and anything second.
Yeah, and never say, that's a Downs, that's a handicap, that's an Alzheimer, or me, a half-zimer. I was going to bring out this example. A very good friend of mine now, his name is Jim Dorn, is a retired veterinarian, and he was very concerned about people with Alzheimer's. And he always wore a rainbow a t-shirt. And they called him Rainbow Jim. And he essentially changed, and he worked with the University of Central Florida on this, and they actually did a study with him going in to patients with Alzheimer's, and really reinforcing, say, you know, you're a great guy, and we really appreciate you being a very positive kind of a thing. And then he took animals in there to them, but he didn't call it the Alzheimer's Wing. They renamed it the Rainbow Wing. And reflect this, and as you made a point, that they're a person, a child of God. And he has changed, he's convinced them that you shouldn't have these kind of patients mixed up with others that don't like when people come into their room half-dressed and sit on their bed and watch television. A lot of people don't appreciate this, but those patients with Alzheimer's, and so they put them all in the same ward and give them room and let them walk around. Give them freedom. And he's having a great impact on this, but also making this point. And I'll never forget Fritz Norstedt, who was interim director here and one of the great human beings on earth. He lives down in Leavenworth. And I'll never forget when he was a counselor at the seminary. And they'd go out and visit people who were severely affected mentally and other things. And one of them, one of these that they had all knew, died. And she was what a lot of people would say, maybe sort of a vegetable. Terrible expression, but. And they got in a conversation, you know, what's this life worth? They collected up her material. You know, it was a few paper clips, a bobby pin, and the whole thing, maybe it was 10 cents, and it was all worth less than a buck, probably. And they had the funeral, and he and his interns went out. They were the only ones at the funeral. And they said some words over the body. And they were standing there, somewhat perplexed, I guess. And you know, what was his life worth? And one of them said, that's Jesus. That's Jesus. And essentially, that's what he says in Matthew 25, isn't it? I was in prison and you visited me. And he didn't say that he was in prison for false reasons. I mean, he was in prison because they'd done something bad. He identifies with these kind of people. And when you can see that lady or the people I see in all kinds of situations and you work with every day, if you say, that's Jesus, it puts a bit of a different light on it. A remarkable different light on it. And I'm glad you brought that up. And I catch myself doing it.
It's hard to correct yourself, or it's hard to make that correction once you've done it so long, but yeah. Now I'm finding it second nature, and it makes a signal when I hear other people saying it, and I no longer have to think about saying it the way, stating personhood first.
Yeah.
But it takes a while to make that change, but it's a simple change that if you know, general society makes and thinks about, it lends a lot to the situation.
To have personhood, to emphasize the personhood. And we want to make a point of that on here, and I'm glad you brought it up, and you must keep bringing it up. Yes?
This is in a different area, but my husband had emphysema and he had to have oxygen. Many people that have to have oxygen and they had it camilla in their nose.
Yeah.
They feel like a freak.
That's right.
Because people avoid them.
That's right.
And what you should do is go up and say hello.
Yeah.
And treat them as a person.
Yeah.
And then they don't feel like a freak. And I always make a point to do that. But that is another area, but it's...
Yeah, we don't treat these people properly. And I'll never forget, I went to a conference when we were trying to decide as professionals, Can say a deaf person and a blind person be a pharmacist or a veterinarian or a physician? And we had a blind person, a person who was sightless. He'd lost his sight at 9. And we had a person who was deaf from birth, who who had finally, although qualified for medical school at 22, finally got in at 40. And he had just gotten out. And I'll never forget, well, my conversation with both of them, but I'll never forget what this person who is sightless said. Well, first of all, the pharmacist dean says, well, there's no way you could be a pharmacist if you're blind. And he says, what's your problem? He says, I was a chemist and I formed a chemical company and I couldn't afford a chemist, so I had to be the chemist. But he told me that on his way of flying out to Seattle for this meeting from Baltimore where he has his business, he was sitting in an airplane coming out, and here was the aisle seat, and there was a vacancy, and then he was in the seat next to him, and he had a white cane. And the stewardess said to the person in the aisle, what would you like to drink? And then she turned to the person who was blind and says, and what would you like to drink? You know, he says, hearing is not my problem. He's a good joke. But that we do not regard them. I know my wife, those hearing handicapped have this problem. People don't know how to deal with it. Even physicians and nurses don't know how to deal with it. They turn the other way when they should be facing them to lip read. They raise their voices for a while and then let it fall down so you can't hear them. So we got a lot to learn. And that's our plea. So keep doing what you're doing. Be compassionate. Yes.
I have a friend that's in a wheelchair, and like if I go with her to the store, if she has an eye appointment, they'll talk to me. They will not talk to her. And that's really a problem for people that are in wheelchairs. If they go with someone, they think they're illiterate. They're in a wheelchair, even if that person is intelligent.
Yeah, sometimes they'll even talk to you as the person to bring a message to them.
Yes.
Yeah. You're the translator. Yeah. I've actually seen that.
You have to do individual education at that point in time.
Yeah, and
but it is really frustrating.
It makes
for thank you, Becky, for that. Well, we've overstepped our time. Thank you. Thank you.